Like hundreds of cities around the country, Chicago is trying to deal with far too many foreclosed and vacant homes. It's now requiring lenders to ensure that abandoned properties are secured and maintained. Other cities have laws just like that. But the federal government is now suing Chicago over its new rules. It's being seen as a test case that could affect whether a city is allowed to keep lenders on the hook for abandoned properties. From member station WBEZ in Chicago, Odette Youssef reports.
Chicago's old rules put the burden of securing and maintaining vacant homes solely on the shoulders of their owners. But a big increase of foreclosures has highlighted the limits of that approach. In Chicago, thousands of homes have been abandoned, and their owners have disappeared. So when the homes became dangerous or fell into disrepair, Judy Friedland, an attorney for Chicago, says the city picked up the slack.
We can't leave the property vacant and open, so that meant the city had to secure it. So the taxpayers were paying to secure the building, in essence.
And it's not cheap. One estimate puts the cost to Chicago taxpayers at $36 million in 2010 alone. And Friedland says that's just not fair.
The city wasn't a part of this transaction. We weren't part of that mortgage. The owner and the lender made an agreement. So why should the taxpayers be the one to come in and have to pay for an agreement that went south?
So in November, Chicago started making lenders responsible too. Now, if an owner's up to 45 days delinquent on the mortgage, the lender has to check if the home's been abandoned. If it has, the lender then has to secure it and register it with the city for a $500 fee. After that, the lender has to keep it up to city code or risk hefty daily fines. But Richard Gottlieb says this is now creating more problems.
How does one know that property is vacant?
Gottlieb directs the financial industry group for the law firm Dykema. He says the cities that have enacted similar ordinances are putting lenders in an impossible position.
Lawsuits are being brought by the dozen by borrowers claiming that their property wasn't really abandoned and that the lender servicer went in without permission. And judges all throughout are looking at those cases very seriously because that is a trespass.
That's also part of what the federal government argues in a lawsuit challenging Chicago's new rules. The Federal Housing Finance Agency sued on behalf of the two lenders that it regulates, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which own more than 250,000 mortgages in Chicago alone. For now, they're complying with the city's ordinance, but they say Chicago unfairly makes them act like an owner before the property is legally theirs. They also argue that Congress made the FHFA their sole regulator, so they shouldn't have to answer to the city of Chicago. While what happens here could affect cities across the country, for Ruben DeSantiago, this is a very local issue. DeSantiago lives on Chicago's south side, and when he saw me and a community organizer checking out a vacant home on his block, he hurried over to us.
I live across the street, and there's a lot of gang activity in this house.
Right.
I mean, I called the police a couple of times, and there's kids that go in, they go out. There's a guy that parks trucks on the back, and I got kids, so...
Yeah, we're trying to figure it out.
For now, DeSantiago and his neighbors mow the lawn and pick up trash here. But he says somebody needs to be held responsible for this house. This lawsuit may determine whether that will be lenders when owners disappear. For NPR News, I'm Odette Youssef.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Trailer parks have an image problem. There are nice ones, of course, but the stereotype is more run-down, rusty mobile homes perched on the outskirts of town or out in the country. Millions of Americans live in these communities and struggle to get ahead. New Hampshire Public Radio's Dan Gorenstein has the story of a small nonprofit called Rock USA. It tries to make life better for trailer park residents.
Every morning, Judy Stoddard picks herself up out of bed and drives to Boston. Monday through Friday.
And I do the back roads, which gets me there in an hour and 40 minutes.
Judy is 71 years old.
I'm exhausted when I get there. I'm exhausted when I come home.
She drives those back roads for a reason.
I don't see well. My vision isn't as good.
That's an understatement. She can't see out of one eye. But as long as her rent keeps creeping up, she keeps going back to work.
I can't retire. I want to keep my house. I put a lot of work in this house. I don't want to lose it.
Judy's caught in this vice grip that's familiar to nearly 3 million Americans. They own their mobile home, but rent the land underneath. See, despite the name, these homes aren't mobile. So if the current owner lets the park deteriorate, or a new owner decides to build a grocery store on the land, people like Judy Stoddard could wind up losing the home they live in and the financial investment they've made. Owning the home and renting the land also makes it nearly impossible to build equity like any other homeowner. Rock USA's mission, the reason they exist, is to ensure that people in mobile home parks are treated like homeowners everywhere else.
This is worth looking at over here on the wall.
Rock USA President Paul Bradley has framed up this quote in his office.
A pile of rocks ceases to be a rock pile when somebody contemplates it with the idea of a cathedral in mind.
That's how it is for Bradley in mobile home parks. He sees what few others do. One, he believes parks are an important part of the nation's affordable housing stock, especially out in the country. And two, because lots of residents already own homes, they're in a position to profit. What Bradley's group does is help people form a co-op when a park comes up for sale. If the co-op's bid is accepted, Rock finances the deal. And poof, these tenants are transformed into homeowners with control over the land beneath their feet.
Since we launched in 2008, Rock USA has helped 2,200 homeowners in 35 communities purchase their parks and gain economic security.
Rock's work in 2012 is projected to more than double over last year. That means helping some 1,000 families, including Judy Stoddard. Bradley wants to triple that.
We are dead serious about scaling our impact.
Scaling our impact is Bradley's way of saying he's not satisfied being some niche artisan goat cheese producer. This guy wants to be craft.
I want resident ownership to be available to every homeowner group in the country that wants to buy their community.
Rock USA has a long way to get there. Today, there are an estimated 50,000 mobile home parks nationwide. Bradley says about 1,000 are currently resident-owned co-ops. So a lot of his time is taken up hunting for investors. And Bradley's had success with backing from foundations like Ford, Rockefeller, and Calvert. But Rock wants to tap more than the social investor class. Bradley wants profit-hungry Wall Street types, people with deep pockets.
We met Paul Bradley and the team and concluded that they've got a great business model and a great opportunity.
That's Dan Letendra with Bank of America. Bank of America has put $13 million into Rock, and Letendra believes resident-owned mobile home parks could be a big business, but it's going to take time. The banker says most major investors don't carry community organizing outfits in their portfolios.
Investors tend to invest in things that they know. In the end, this will work when investors look at the track record and conclude, I can lend Rock USA money, I can invest in Rock USA, and I can get a good, safe, attractive return and get my capital back.
Bradley takes all that to heart. As he knocks on doors, he opens with Rock's track record.
On over $200 million worth of total lending, not a single lender has lost a single dollar over the course of the last 30 years.
When it comes to the people who own the parks, the potential sellers, most of them have never heard of Paul Bradley or Rock USA's seemingly impressive track record. But when they do, George Allen, an Indianapolis-based owner, says most of them are open-minded. What trips some up, says Allen, is the idea that their tenants will become owners.
Because they have to take them to small claims court often to get their money. Because they've got to go and mow the grass because they don't take enough responsibility to mow their own grass. In other words, when you deal with those kind of things every day, day and day, the idea of thinking of these people that generally are incapable being in charge of their own destiny.
The issue Allen raises might be Rock USA's biggest challenge, the notion that these people aren't capable of helping themselves. What's interesting about what Rock is doing is that by changing the rules of the game, these people have a chance to prove skeptics wrong. Gary Tulene used to have a nickname for his 1967 single wide.
The dump.
Gary lives with his wife in Breezy Acres, a small New Hampshire park that went co-op back in 1991.
We did have mold problems. The roof did leak. We were ill all the time. We had pails to catch the rainwater. It was horrible.
About 2 years ago, the couple locked down a $50,000 loan. No small feat for a guy with almost no credit. But the nonprofit lender understands, and most importantly, trusts this co-op model. So the couple bought themselves a brand new three-bedroom mobile home, putting it right where the dump had sat.
The first thing I wanted to do was invite some people over for coffee for a long time, 20 years. Couldn't ever do that. I was embarrassed about my home. Boy, I got out of jail, man. I got out of jail.
Finally, the 70-year-old feels set up. Changing the economic model changes everything. It means a guy who's chased money forever can rest. Gary says he has something now that he's never known before.
I really can have my own place and be a respectable part of a community. And we were never allowed to do that before, people in my situation. And I'm not a second-class citizen anymore. And I'll be damned if we're going to be thought that way. I'm a citizen and a part of a community.
Gary says stability used to be a dream. Now, he says, he and his wife could sell their home, pay off the loan, and walk away with 10 grand. When Rock USA's Paul Bradley dreams, he dreams of Gary Tulin. Lots and lots of Gary Tulins. For NPR News, I'm Dan Gorenstein in Concord, New Hampshire.
This is NPR News.
The news keeps getting worse for Spain. This week came word that the country has fallen back into recession. Meanwhile, Spain's unemployment rate is the highest in Europe. And now investors are once again fleeing the country and interest rates on government debt are climbing. NPR's Jim Zaroli explores how Spain became Europe's latest ailing country.
The numbers coming out of Spain these days are stark. The economy shrank 0.3 percentage point during the first part of this year. Housing prices are down 21%, and unemployment is nearly 25%.
There's no doubt that from an objective labor market point of view, it's a disaster.
Jacob Kierkegaard is a research fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
This was simply the levels that we had at the bottom of the Great Depression in the 1930s.
Spain's economy has fallen further and faster than any European country but Ireland's. In the mid-2000s, armies of British and Dutch people flooded into the country to buy property, and Spain experienced a massive real estate bubble. Countless Spaniards found jobs building and selling condos. Now the bubble has popped, and Spain is having to rebuild its economy. Juan Rubio Ramirez, professor of economics at Duke University, says Spain has long had something of a competitiveness problem.
But the problem is that we are not selling anything that the world is interested in. For a while, we were building these houses that the people were interested in buying, but the world is not interested in those anymore.
The Spanish government has taken steps it says will make businesses more competitive. It ended nationwide collective bargaining, and it made it easier for companies to fire people. Whatever the long-term benefits of that move, in the short term, it's only made the unemployment problem worse. As the economy shrinks, so too do government revenues, and investors are growing more worried about the country's ability to pay its debts. Juan Rubio Ramirez says part of the problem is the decentralized Spanish government. He says Madrid collects taxes and funnels the revenue to regional governments, which get to spend it.
These guys more or less have total freedom to spend whatever they want. They don't pay the political cost of tax for those things.
This, he says, has complicated efforts to control spending. Spain has lower debt levels than many countries, including the United States. But investors have grown more skeptical that Spain can pay off the debts it does have. There are also fears that Madrid will have to bail out the country's banks. Jacob Kierkegaard says many are still loaded with bad real estate loans.
They have not been willing to engage or act forcefully enough on this issue. There has been a fair amount of denial going on here.
As investors have fled, interest rates have risen and the cost of borrowing has gone up. Madrid has also agreed to spending cuts, but it recently said it would have trouble implementing them, and that caused interest rates to spike again. But not everyone is so pessimistic. Nicholas Heinen, an economist at Deutsche Bank, says Spain has made some important reforms that will benefit the country in the long run.
Spain has to reach a balance between austerity measures on the one hand and growth-oriented policies on the other hand. Spain is on a good way, but some investors have not realized that and they are still skeptical.
Spain is trying hard to address that skepticism and assure investors it can pay its debts. But the road ahead is a long one, and no one doubts that the next few months will be challenging. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
While California's state budget woes have contributed to the stress on public university kids there, students across the country are feeling the squeeze in other ways. More than 7 million students could face a doubling of their federal loan rates if Congress can't agree on a plan to prevent it. At the same time, students of all backgrounds are coming of age in an era when the economy is always described as recovering, never recovered. So, with graduation coming up, how are they feeling about their prospects?
Gosh, not that good.
This is Caitlin Peterson. She's 23. We found her when we went to the University of Maryland in College Park. She's a grad student there in Library and Information Studies. It's the kind of school where the shuttle buses have perky slogans on the side. They say things like, "Hey, recession, fear the turtle." That's the school's mascot, a diamondback terrapin. But right now, students like Caitlin say the recession has the edge over the turtle.
Considering that we're all graduating with thousands and thousands of dollars of debt already, to go into an economy that's not hiring, a lot of people are moving back in with their parents. A lot of people are working part-time crap jobs.
25-year-old Amanda Mason-Singh, same boat.
I have a lot of debt. I think it's over $100,000. So, because I've been to a bachelor's program, a master's program, and now I'm in a PhD program.
And at the end of the day, you look at this economy and think it's going to be better, worse, middling. What are your chances? What are you looking forward to?
I think it's good. I mean, I think I'm still optimistic. Like, I think here.
You're still optimistic.
I just want to talk about it.
You have $100,000 in debt. You're not sure you'll ever work.
I feel very confident about, like, working. So I know I have an internship next year. So I'm not concerned about finding a job afterwards. I think it's just a matter of thinking of how much debt I do have and how much I will have to work in order to pay that off.
She's hoping she'll find a job with her doctorate in human development. Then there are the pragmatists, just starting out or recalibrating their plans as the economy chugs along.
My name is Akeem Alade. I'm a current sophomore at the University of Maryland, planning to major in civil engineering. I'm from PG County, Maryland. Go Terps.
Akeem Alade started out planning to major in business. Seems like a good idea, right? Not according to Akeem's father.
Before I came to college, he had me read a couple of articles. I know I read one about this girl who was top of her class, valedictorian and everything, majored in business, but she couldn't find a job, and she was working as a waitress, and she was unemployed for, I think, about 3 years after she got out of college.
Akeem didn't think he could argue with that cautionary tale. Meanwhile, 22-year-old Andrew Hanlon, he's placing his bets with a science degree as well, in kinesiology. That's the study of body movement.
With all the baby boomers retiring and everything like that, they need health care, and physical therapists are one of the major providers of
that. So you got a plan. That's a great plan.
Yeah.
Do you get the sense, though, that basically your generation is walking into good, bad, what kind of situation?
I mean, I think we got screwed over pretty good, but we know the environment we're walking into. It's not like we don't know.
It's pretty scary. If you do think about it.
That's Lev Heller. He's 18. Even though it's scary, he's been thinking a lot about his generation.
I think in a way most generations get a raw deal. I think that we think things are really bad at any given point, but the fact is it's not really that they suddenly change for worse. There's a new problem for every generation to deal with, and most of the time we have dealt with it.
Not surprisingly, Lev Heller is a philosophy major, and he has a plan to prepare for this economy, to spend more time in school, in his case, medical school.